This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll visit an online space where people from around the country have been sharing memories of people they've lost during the pandemic. Now, 1 in 4 women are expected to get an abortion at some point in their lives, a procedure that officially became constitutionally protected in 1973. A draft U.S. Supreme Court decision leaked to the press earlier this week indicating that the court is likely to overturn that landmark decision, leaving regulation of abortion rights to the states. If Roe v. Wade is officially overturned when the court announces its decision this summer, 22 states would likely ban abortion, and at least 9 of those states there would be no exception for pregnancies resulting from rape or incest. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What has your reaction to this news been? Would an end to the federal protection of abortion affect you personally? If this goes to the states completely, what do you want to see states do? What do you want to see your state do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Clara McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She studies the politics of gender and reproductive health, including abortion. Claire, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
As someone who's studied the history of abortion law in the United States, what stood out to you in this leaked draft document?
I think just the sheer breadth of the document in terms of repudiating any basis for asserting a right to abortion. There's no exception to the idea that there's no right, no liberty for abortion to be found in the Constitution, in common practice, and in how we think about abortion as a practice today. That it repudiates a whole host of history that suggests that abortion has been in common practice through American history, even before it was a nation. And it's a pretty stark repudiation of the past 50 years of American jurisprudence.
If this is, in fact, the Supreme Court's ultimate decision in the summer, is there a time in American history that you would compare to a post-Roe landscape?
Yeah, so immediately before Roe v. Wade, from about 1968 to 1973, I think gives us the most stark point of comparison. This was a period of time after several states had already liberalized their abortion laws, and you saw abortion counseling networks work to help get women access to the money necessary to go to states like New York, to go to countries like Mexico or Japan, if you lived in Hawaii, in order to have access to abortion. What that meant is that abortion was really about stratified access. If you had money, it didn't matter where you lived in the country, you could still have access to abortion. If you didn't, then you often made recourse to criminal abortion, which put you at the whims of people who were inexperienced, unscrupulous, and ultimately put the health of countless women in danger. Beyond that, many women testified to just how humiliating and degrading the experience was. So, as many commentators have noted, making abortion criminal doesn't get rid of abortion. It gets rid of safe access to abortion, and it makes sure that women make recourse to criminal methods for control of their fertility.
What are some of the key differences today, 2022, versus those last few years pre-Roe v. Wade that you would point toward?
So two of the largest issues are thinking about how much surveillance is part of our lives today versus pre-Roe. We're tracked on our cell phones. We make appointments through electronic means. We can be tracked in terms of what we order in the mail. All of these things have vastly expanded how people can be tracked if they make recourse to criminal means. At the same time, we also see vastly new forms of access to safe abortion. So abortion pills, medical kind of governed abortion makes it safe up through even 12 weeks, according to the WHO. And so you'll find people making recourse to less dangerous means once abortion is criminalized. At the same time, we see states like Texas, Oklahoma, Idaho, deputizing citizens as surveillance agents in order to ensure that women don't feel safe when seeking abortion care.
Now, according to the Mayo Clinic, about somewhere from 10 to 20% of known pregnancies end in a miscarriage. Does that, with that kind of surveillance you're talking about, does that raise questions about how enforcement would work, distinguishing between a miscarriage that could occur to anyone at any time versus an abortion or someone taking abortion pills?
Right. So the issue cuts both ways. A medical abortion is indistinguishable from a non-induced miscarriage. And so if there are complications, there is no reason that somebody would have to disclose how their miscarriage, how the end of their pregnancy was affected. By the same token, however, this creates new scrutiny of anybody who's experiencing a miscarriage. Across the country, we've already seen people who have non-induced miscarriages criminalized. In Indiana, a woman was sentenced to 20 years in prison because of a miscarriage. And so in a state and a political environment where there is a heightened desire for the punishment of women or anybody who terminates a pregnancy, miscarriages will become increasingly suspect as well, endangering even those who are not seeking abortion care.
Clara McKinney is with us from the College of William and Mary, looking at the leaked Roe v. Wade document from the Supreme Court, indicating that there are enough justices willing to overturn that, not the final decision that's expected this summer. You can join in with your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. What is this a decision you'd be happy to see? Are you worried about it? What do you want to see states do if, in fact, this is the final word from the U.S. Supreme Court? Call in at 800-642-1234. I want to look at some of the specifics of the laws in states around the country. You've mentioned Texas's. That one, people have pointed out, no exceptions for victims of rape or incest resulting in a pregnancy, some trigger laws in other states as well. It's been pointed out that that's kind of a change in the movement against abortion. Ronald Reagan, who worked against abortion, favored those exceptions. What do you make of that that change?
I do think that this is one of the largest changes from even mid-century. So rape and incest exceptions were first proposed by the American Law Institute in the 1950s and became the model for liberalization of abortion laws across the country. So states like Georgia, states like Colorado accepted these very narrow notions that in cases of rape or incest, fetal abnormality or the health of women should all be reasons why access to abortion should be legal. The turn against rape and incest really demonstrates that for many states, there's not even the need to pretend that this is a pro-women decision. The notion of the primacy of fetal rights over and above the health and well-being of women and other people who can get pregnant really indicates that this has become such a polarized and extreme issue that there's not room for us to show compassion to anybody who is seeking an abortion.
Are there other laws in states around the country either likely to revert into place or so-called trigger laws that you are keeping a particularly close eye on?
Yeah, I think that right now, Missouri has floated a law that would ban individuals from going outside of the state to have abortions. This is the first time that we haven't seen the invocation of interstate bans that are directed to those who are seeking abortions. That really is an attempt to contravene the idea that if somebody wants to seek an abortion, they should be able to go to a state where it is available. And so that shows an increasingly high level of extremism. There are also several states, as you know, Wisconsin is one of them, where pre-Roe bans on abortion were never taken off the books. And so it will be really at the discretion of state officials of whether or not to enforce those laws. So those will become, I think, increasingly part of how we think about the new landscape of abortion.
Clara McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She's talking to us about what it could be like if Roe v. Wade is officially overturned this summer by the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you remember a time before Roe v. Wade? Do you have thoughts to share with us? Do you think if Roe is overturned, it'll be the same as back then or different? Do you want Roe v. Wade to be overturned or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Clara McKinney, assistant professor at the College of William and Mary, talking about what things in the U.S. could look like if Roe v. Wade is overturned, as a draft decision leaked to the press has indicated might happen this summer. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Frank is with us in La Crosse. Frank, hello.
Hi. With all due respect to your guest, in addition to the immediate effects of this ruling, if it goes forward, on women and the misogynistic attitudes that are embodied in it in terms of putting women back in a place where they don't have freedom and don't have power, I think people of all political persuasions need to be alarmed by the reasoning in the brief, which would dramatically or would provide a basis to dramatically reduce individual freedoms and the right to privacy across the political spectrum and across all aspects of the society. It's a much larger issue than just abortion, although abortion, of course, is a critical and important issue. Thank you.
Frank, thanks for the call. Claire, is that a concern you share?
Absolutely. So the leaked decision very clearly lays out that anything that is not explicitly spelled out in the Constitution as a protected liberty has to be rooted in the deep-seated traditions of the United States, which means prior to 1868, there must be a track record that there was an acknowledgement that there was no state authority to regulate these practices. What that means for women, for LGBTQ folks, for racial minorities, all means a huge rollback of liberties. I'll also state that the way that the decision tries to say abortion is the only thing this relies on is to say that the issue of fetal life is one that is morally contentious. But all of the things that we're concerned about now, thinking about the finding unconstitutional anti-sodomy laws, gay marriage, same-sex marriage, thinking about even interracial marriage and contraception, all of these are also issues where we can see moral debate ongoing in the country. And so if the logic is, if it's morally contentious and not rooted in pre-1868 America, then you don't have that liberty, you can see a significant rollback of any recognition of rights for a whole host of minorities.
Frank, thanks for that call. Go to Barbara next in Madison. Barbara, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Barbara?
I have two things to say. I'm a retired nurse anesthetist and nurse. I also have a master's in microbiology. And I hear two arguments from the pro-life people, which I'm pro-life, but I'm also in favor of abortions when necessary, that they don't seem to understand. And one of them is that there is no problem in our society with pronouncing somebody brain dead. And yet they contend that an embryo or a fetus prior to the development of a functioning brain is alive. I don't understand it doesn't make sense. And the other one is this heartbeat bill. Well, at 6 weeks, which is when they're defining it, there is no functional heart. There's a small mass of tissue, but it's not shaped like a heart. It doesn't pump blood. It's not functional. And they talk about, I heard the heartbeat. No, what you heard was a manufactured sound from the sonogram. That is not the heartbeat. The heart is not beating. There are some tissues that are electrically stimulated, but it's like a twitch in your eye. It's not a heartbeat. And I don't think that they understand the difference.
Barbara, thanks for the call. Claire, Barbara getting into an issue of where we consider life to begin and where deadlines are placed on when abortions can happen.
I think that this is a crucial part of the debate that one often kind of looks to as how can we actually settle this in a non-arbitrary way. Unfortunately, I agree with Barbara that any lines that we draw always bring up questions and cases of how do we consider these other ideas, right? Oftentimes we think about how do we think about fertility clinics that store embryos and those fertilized embryos. Why is there not an uproar when those are destroyed when people who had fertility issues decide that they no longer want those embryos? It also brings up the fact that conception itself is not an act, it's a process. Do we say that this happens at fertilization, at implantation? All of these call into question the hard and fast lines that we try to make between life and not life. And honestly, also shows one of the reasons why contraception is in danger on the basis of this ruling if it becomes law.
Thanks, Barbara, for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Clara McKinney from the College of William and Mary, looking at abortion, past and future in the United States, with it looking likely that the Supreme Court is ready to overturn Roe v. Wade. Back to your calls now. AJ is with us in Green Bay. AJ, hello.
Hello there. How's it going today? My comment is more of a comment, not really a question. If they successfully rolled this back into banning abortions and stuff, okay, for the conservatives, what is the next step? Are you going to go back and try to get prohibition reinstated? And if you were successful at that, are you going to try to get slavery reinstated in the southern part of the United States? How far are you willing to drag this nation backward in time?
AJ, thanks for the call. Claire, I believe the post-Civil War amendments would pretty specifically prevent the restoration of slavery, but AJ is wondering in what other ways, we talked about this a little earlier, in what other ways could this, in effect, turn back the clock?
Yeah, I think anytime that we see the invocation of states' rights, that often accompanies with the idea of we need to resist the rights and recognition of the full citizenship of people who were previously denied it. So I think in terms of turning back the clock, the most obvious places that you'll see really conservative legislatures go towards is banning same-sex marriage, reintroducing perhaps anti-sodomy laws. But I think that we'll also see contestation over things like IUDs and other forms of birth control that some consider forms of abortifacients, that is, procedures that stop conception from resulting in the development of a fetus. So I think there's a lot of danger here. We've already actually seen the clock turn back on issues like voting rights with Citizens United. We saw the repudiation that the federal government has responsibility for guaranteeing that especially Black Americans, but really any racial minorities ought to be protected in voting. So this is not the first salvo, and it won't be the last in returning us to a time before the full rights and recognition of all people as citizens is taking place.
Thanks for the call. Michael joins us next in Park Falls. Michael, hello.
Hi. My question is along the lines, I guess it's a technical matter. We always hear about exceptions for rape and incest. You know, historically, that was sort of a common exception, but I'm wondering how does that work? Like when who decides that that event has occurred? Did historically a doctor? Did a court? Because it seems like it's not just.
Michael, that's a good question, Claire. How do those exceptions work on a practical level?
So luckily, since Roe v. Wade and Doe v. Bolton, the companion case that we typically don't talk about, rape and incest exceptions haven't really been all that important in how we think about this. I don't know of any cases where the kind of claims of rape or incest have played a role. And unlike the kind of track record of requiring minors to have parental notification or parental consent, there's not really an explicit role for the judiciary to step in order to make these determinations. So what I do think that the question really shows, though, is that when people are asked why they're seeking an abortion, less than 1% ever bring up rape or incest. The vast majority of people who are seeking abortions are doing so for economic reasons, for reasons of their greater kind of fertility life planning. Many of these people, the majority, are already have children. And so the rape or incest oftentimes is one that plays on our sympathy, but doesn't really guide much in terms of the actual practice of abortion.
Thanks for that call. Claire, in our last minute or so, Democrats in Congress and a couple of Republican senators have said, okay, we need to enshrine the protections of Roe v. Wade in legislation. Some Republicans in the Senate are talking about working on a nationwide ban on abortion if they managed to take control of Congress and eventually the White House. What are you watching for from Congress now?
Honestly, I don't think that there's a lot from Congress that we can hope to see one way or the other. I think that we will continue to see campaigning on these issues, but in terms of having the votes to get over the 60 vote threshold for cloture, you're not going to see much of anything beyond just kind of this activity in raising it to the national level of our consciousness.
And briefly, it's all up to the states then, if in fact Roe v. Wade is overturned?
Yeah, just like the past 40 years, the action will all be on the level of the states.
Claire, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire McKinney is an assistant professor of government and gender, sexuality, and women's studies at the College of William and Mary. She studies the politics of gender and reproductive health, including abortion. She talked to us today about what could happen if Roe v. Wade is in fact overturned. Again, a Supreme Court leaked draft suggests that it is likely to be overturned this summer. Join Great Conversations every weekday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 8, have some fun. It's a good time to watch for birds here in Wisconsin. Get some advice, and you could share your own sightings out in nature or maybe in your own backyard. Send pictures, too. They love those. Email central or email ideas at WPR.org. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Hey, do you have a second? If so, which second? The old one or the new one? As reported in the New York Times, researchers at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures are getting ready to change the way they define a second. Now, you and I won't notice the difference. Seconds won't get any longer or shorter. So why change it? The goal is to make that unit of time more precise. We humans used to use the sun and other stars and the Earth's rotation to define our units of time. And that works really well in the short run. But for long periods of time, orbits and rotations can slow down just a little bit at a time. And if you're doing serious physics, you need your units of measurement built to last. Right now, the science world uses cesium atoms and their decay to count time, and that's pretty accurate. The goal is to do it even better. Scientists are going to fight it out with a group of elements in optical atomic clocks that'll make things even more precise. That decision will be made over the next couple of years, give or take a second or two. Time news you can use. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll meet the creator of the online memorial project, Who We Lost, where people can pay tribute to loved ones lost during the pandemic. First, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about Ramadan, which wrapped up earlier this week.
1.8 billion Muslims all over the world observe the holy month of Ramadan. That includes the children at the Crescent Learning Center, an Islamic childcare center in Milwaukee. Reporter Christina Leffring tells us the center's founder strives to help refugee children and their parents feel at home during the holiday and through the rest of the year.
Crescent Learning Center is like any typical childcare center. Kids play with clay.
It's a teddy bear.
They make gifts for Mother's Day. And, of course, there's Baby Shark. But it's also unique because this is an Islamic childcare center, And it's the month of Ramadan, the holiest month of the year for Muslims.
The kids get excited about Ramadan.
That's Rafat Arain, the founder and director at Crescent Learning Center. The kids we just heard are too young to fast, which means no food or water from sunrise to sunset. But their families still wake up early to eat a big breakfast before sunrise and share a big feast at the end of the day when the sun sets. The whole community gathers in homes and at mosques to celebrate. And for the kids who are old enough to fast, it is a joyous rite of passage.
The parents do put more effort in making their favorite things, samosas and all those brownies and all of those, the things that the kids love. It's exciting for the kids.
It's also a lesson in gratitude for what you have and empathy for those who have less than you.
There are so many people in this world that don't have any food. We are giving up this food out of choice, but a lot of people have no choice. They just don't have the food. So you feel their pain too. You have to feel the pain of hunger that a lot of people are going through.
Which may be closer to home than the children realize. Arain, who's originally from Pakistan, started working with refugees in 1993, when her family took in a family that had fled the war in Bosnia. Since then, she's worked to help each new wave of refugees resettle in Milwaukee. Somali, Burmese, Rohingya, and most recently, Afghan.
I think I have a weakness for the refugees somehow. I was never a refugee myself, but I just feel that it would be... I came to this country, I spoke English, I was educated, I didn't have to, you know, go through all of that. We are in this world for a purpose, not just to eat and drink and sleep and take care of ourselves. We have to do it for others. If I have this education, it's not for me to keep it to myself, it is to share it with others. That's everything that we have.
She decided to open the childcare center when she saw refugee kids were falling behind in school. The center opens early and closes late to accommodate parents' work schedules. And during the pandemic, the center stayed open and staff helped the kids with virtual school. Arain's office is set up to welcome parents with tea, snacks, and a sofa where they can sit and talk. She's also hired staff from several refugee communities.
See, I have Burmese staff, I have Somali staff, I have Arabic staff, I have Moroccan staff. When those people come to me, I have translators over here. A lot of parents depend on me. They have problems. I have the sofa, they come. It's a good thing. Someday I might need help. God will send somebody for me.
Back in the classroom, children are encouraged to give to charity. And as the teachers warm up their halal lunch, they remind the children to say Bismillah.
Say Bismillah!
A blessing before eating their rice and vegetables. Most of these children are too young to fast for Ramadan or to remember what their families went through when they left their home countries. But one day they'll join millions of Muslims around the world as they remember to be grateful for the roof over their head, the food on their plate, and the people who've helped them call Milwaukee home.
Christina Leffring brought us that story on Ramadan and the Crescent Learning Center in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, a lot of people have lost loved ones during the pandemic, and grieving has been difficult, at first because in-person ceremonies were largely off the table, and later because so many elements of the disease got tied up in political debate. Our next guest set out to change that with a website that is helping people grieve COVID-related deaths in their lives by sharing written anecdotes. The website provides a space for those memories that's explicitly free from negative pandemic-related comments. Martha Greenwald is a writer based in Kentucky and founder of the Who We Lost Project. Martha, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Where did you first get the inspiration to launch this?
So this project has really evolved a lot. We began sort of inspired by the particularly empathic response that Kentucky had at the beginning of the pandemic, but then word began to get out about it nationally. And I fielded numerous requests from people who wanted to write stories from outside the state. Personally, my own father was killed in a strange accident about a decade ago, and the pandemic helped me to see how much disenfranchised grief I was still carrying with me, there's a lot of parallels to that with COVID deaths, the inability to say goodbye, the uncertainty, family dysfunction, and it awakened a lot of things in me. And in combination with the fact of having taught writing for 20 years, and I wanted all that experience to be useful to others. And so I feel it's kind of a calling for me.
Can you give us a couple examples of things people have written that we might see on your site?
Sure. I'll give you a story, well, a little excerpt of a story first from Colorado. This story is about Kyle Spiller, and it was written by his mom. And the title is Dog Boy and Holiday Guy. One thing I should say that's important about the site is that everyone has to put a title on their story. I feel like it gives it a sense of narrative, and it kind of gives it a dignity to it that I feel is rather essential. So this is from Dog Boy and Holiday Guy. Kyle was our holiday maker. He refused to let a holiday go by without a get together. The only one we missed was Christmas 2020 because I was just too nervous about the virus. But that Thanksgiving, we had a big meal in the living room of our half-finished house. Bare gray block walls, a late November Colorado breeze blowing through the many openings yet to be filled with windows and doors, a football game on the TV, a microwave to reheat the quickly cooling food. A memorable day, to say the least. We sat across the room from each other in green lawn chairs, Mike and I on one side, Kyle and Charlotte on the other, but we were together, and that's what mattered to Kyle. And I really love that story because there's so many details in it that I feel are just, you know, such a good evocation of social isolation and everything that everyone else was going through, really exemplified there.
And so many of your examples, I compare them to obituaries. You know, I've read them. I've helped write them for family members who have passed. I feel like in these stories, even sometimes just one-line excerpts, I know more about a person than in reading a whole obituary. Can you talk about how you suggest people dig into those feelings and find those unique things?
Sure. So one thing that we have on the site is a writing toolbox, because a lot of people are writing hesitant, or it harkens back to like bad English class memories from years ago or something like that. So I just kind of do what I did when I was teaching, which is we provide examples. So I really believe if you show people what a detail is and, you know, what a memory is that should be important, that it easily helps them conjure that up for themselves. So the writing toolbox helps. And then also in our social media campaigns, I post sort of 1 to 2 sentence micro stories that are specific and help people evoke what's going on for them at that time.
Some of those are amazing. The one sentence was, I jotted a couple of those down. One was his favorite karaoke song was Rock Lobster. I feel like I know something about that person. I wish I could have hung out with him just knowing that one little snippet.
Yeah, exactly. Like that gives you a time and place, right? It helps you probably remember, you know how old they were without even saying it. And you can picture the whole scene of them and how much you would miss them singing that song. So yeah, that's exactly what we're aiming for, is to, you know, show that it's important to remember those things and not just the hospital and the ventilator.
I think you said you had another reading you could share with us, Martha.
Sure. This is also an excerpt. Some of the stories are, you know, long, mm-hmm. So we can't read them all now. But this is from Kentucky. It's for Mother's Day, which is coming up on Sunday. And I highly encourage people to come write a story for Mother's Day. It's by Shane Terry of Whitesburg, Kentucky. This is a small snippet of his story called Yellow Roses. Recently, I was digging through my archive of old video footage, and I found something that surprised me. It was video of my mother a year before she died, showing me the rose bush at the end of the driveway, the one my sister and I had bought to replace the bushes that had burned up. The new bush that we'd planted was pink or red, I can't remember exactly. But oddly enough, when the bush began to flower, the roses were yellow, the color of hope and light and happiness. My mom was amazed. That's what she's showing us in the video, her joy that they'd transformed themselves. It seemed to be a sign at the time that things would get better, a little miracle that happened to us after losing so much.
What do you think people get out of writing about this grief, especially this, I think you used the phrase, disenfranchised grief?
Well, disenfranchised grief is unfortunately very common right now, and it's commonly what a person would experience when they incur a loss that can't be openly acknowledged or socially sanctioned. Maybe they can't mourn publicly, which was, of course, a big part of the first year, at least, of COVID. So when they have that, they didn't really, you know, get the opportunity due to social isolation to hold in-person funerals, you know. So the things that would have been said at a wake or Shiva, a memorial, were kept silent, and they were maybe rattled off or awkwardly on Zoom. But, you know, Who We Lost offers a space to tell that story, maybe about your best friend from 40 years ago, or the thing that you couldn't say. I'm finding people talk to me a lot lately when I'm out, as though they kind of know, like, what my deal is. And I feel that right now there's memories in the air that are sort of floating like pollen. There's so much sadness and loss and things that have been hidden or suppressed for all the 2 years of isolation, and now they're coming out, and the grief sort of reemerges with the person. So I think, you know, these stories have to be told.
Martha, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That's Martha Greenwald, a writer based in Kentucky, founder of the project Who We Lost. We talked to her today about how that online project is helping people grieve loved ones whose deaths were related to COVID-19 by writing. We'll get a link to Who We Lost at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, staying with the topic of memory and the pandemic, the Wisconsin Historical Society started collecting COVID-19 journal entries from Wisconsinites back in the spring of 2020. We'll get an update on how that project has been going and what people have been sharing. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A project here in the state has been collecting written chronicles of the experiences of Wisconsinites during the pandemic in their own words. That project's one of two that the Wisconsin Historical Society started in the spring of 2020 at the beginning of the novel coronavirus outbreak in the state. They asked people to submit journal entries for historical record and commissioned public information posters as well. We wanted to get an update on how those efforts have gone 2 years now after they started. Christian Overland is the Ruth and Hartley Barker Director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society. Christian, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. It's great to be back with you again.
Can you remind us of the original inspiration to do this journal project?
Oh, sure. So back in March of 2020, when the pandemic was hitting, we started looking at our 1918 pandemic collections, and it was one of our archivists, Jonathan Nelson, who said, you know, if we're going to help people out, we can talk about the public health commissions and what happened back then. There's some good stuff that we can share with the Department of Health Services and the public. But he said, I'm struggling because we don't have the voice of the people from the 1918 pandemic. And so Jonathan proposed in late March that we actually start a journaling project to actually document the voice of the people of Wisconsin that were experiencing the pandemic. And we launched April 2nd. And quite frankly, we thought it was going to be a 30 or 60 or 90 day project. And a couple of years later, here we are.
Yeah, I talked to you a couple years ago at the outset of this project that we were all, I think, hoping would be a short term project. Can you talk about the response you got?
Sure. So we thought this would be interesting for Wisconsin, all 72 counties, and certainly that's panned out. But we've had over 2,500 people sign up to journal. And so people have been contacting Jonathan and his team. We've actually had 218 journals submitted thus far, and people are still working on that. But what's fascinating about it, the last time we talked, Rob, is people were talking about the issue of quarantining, food shortages, you know, being alone, not having human contact. But now we're getting the journals coming in with all that, plus the idea of vaccination. And as you're guest previously discussed, the loss of life too, and that's coming through these journals.
If people are out there thinking, oh, I wish I had done this, could they still join in and pick up where they are now?
Oh, absolutely, Rob. You know, we're never going to close down this project because we think that there's journals still out there, And one of the things that people can do is they can go onto our website and click on collecting as it happens. And they can see how we're documenting the COVID project through journaling. And they have rubrics there, there are prompts for writing. We make it easier for people to create their own journal. The other thing I'll say is it's just not paper. We also collect art journals, video journals, digital journals. Any format is starting to come in.
What are your hopes for the Wisconsinites of the future when they have this collection available to them?
So going back to why Jonathan started this and what's really panned out, the gift to the future is some of the innovations that people have done socially, you know, going through this. They're documenting, you know, what they ate, what were some of the recipes they could buy with limited food connections. They're also documenting what they did on their social time, not being connected with people physically. So some remember some of the Zoom meetings and maybe Zoom parties that were going on. They were documenting that as well. And also documenting what their children were doing with online school, and also how they were dealing with the pandemic, whether they were using the recommendations that the Department of Health Services and CDC were giving out or not, and how they felt about that. So what's great about this is we're giving a voice to the future of how we managed and persevered through the pandemic.
It sounds like there's a lot of variety in responses. If I understand correctly, you've gotten one journal that's 400 pages long. Another has 13 handwritten volumes. Can you give us a sense of the variety that you've gotten from people so far?
So, like I said, they're from all over Wisconsin. Plus, they're from Wisconsinites around the world. So we just received one from Italy in the past few months. We also have them from Texas, California, the East Coast. We know that people are still journaling in different parts of the world. But the other part, too, is it's from all socioeconomic backgrounds. They're very diverse. So from a 14-year-old to a 90-year-old, from poets to people that are doing art journals. Some of the more fascinating ones are people that are drawing and putting articles together and writing about that. There's one journal that actually is using Beatles tunes to actually the lyrics of them to comment on how they feel about it. As a prompt, they'll put a Beatles song out there and write it, draw a little picture, and then talk about what they were feeling that week.
There's a mindset that I always kind of struggle to grasp a little bit here, Christian, that, you know, in my head, sometimes history is back then, but we're living through history now and the future's got to look at this as history. As people write these things, do you get the sense that they're seeing themselves as part of the historical process here?
Definitely they do that. There is that. But we've had a history of that, mm-hmm. You know, Rob, it goes back to the 19th century when our first director sent out with the Civil War troops that were being mustered out of Camp Randall in Madison, journals and pencils, and asking the troops to write about their journeys and bring them back. So there's a self awareness going on just like back then of what they're writing about. But there's also a lot of breakthrough things that are happening too. A lot of people are expressing themselves emotionally and actually how they feel about what's happening in the world during the time. What we could not have thought about back then in March when we launched thinking about this project and launching it in April was like the murder of George Floyd or what's going now with the war of Ukraine. These things are continually to be journaled about. So we're capturing an era of time that's kind of being enveloped by the pandemic, lots of things happening in the world that are being chronicled now by Wisconsin people.
Now, I mentioned earlier there was a companion project with asking people to produce public information posters. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So if people have the image of like Uncle Sam Wants You from World War One, that type of poster, or the 1930s Depression era posters where, you know, we're all working together type of thing from the WPA. We use that type of rubric to work with Wisconsin artists and giving Wisconsin artists voices. So we did a first run of 10 publications of posters, graphic arts posters in 20. And then we did another 10 in 21. And they're fascinating because again, they're coming from diverse artist backgrounds and they were posted in hospitals, schools. One of the things that happened with our journaling project is schools started to get on board, even the colleges. We have classes from Marquette, as well as the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And even the senior citizens home was journaling about it. but they saw the COVID poster projects and they started wanting them too. So it's another voice from the artistic community that's being given a platform to express their ideas. And one of the cool things that happened with it is that from the COVID journaling project, along with the poster project, a professor in Eau Claire, University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, BJ Hollers, decided to write a book called Hope is a Thing. And he used it to kind of add to the collection by asking people to write essays about the COVID project and put them together in a book. And then one of the artists did the cover for it. So in many ways, it's became its own innovation, spurring ideas to document history during the time we're living in today.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Christian Overland, director and CEO of the Wisconsin Historical Society, looking at their journal project. You can find more at wisconsinhistory.org/journalproject. Tomorrow on Central Time, we'll look at the long tradition of music as political protest and how the protest song has changed over time. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then housing in Wisconsin has gotten increasingly unaffordable. Our guest says the problem is a five-alarm fire. We'll hear about the factors contributing to it and what policymakers could do to try to bring those costs down. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Thank you.